Today is Tuesday, September 7th, 2021. This is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Williams. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Tom. I'm fine.
Great. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you have my permission.
Great. Thank you. We left you last time in the fall, September of 1974. You and your family had moved back to Washington, D.C. Your wife was thrilled because she was from D.C. and had family there. Family who was looking forward to grandchildren and playing with them. So that was good. And the job you took at the time, you know, you've been doing some amazing stuff teaching, but this was a job with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington, D.C., in the Endangered Species Office. That was a lot different than teaching. Can you kind of tell us what your duties were there and some of the issues that were going on there when you showed up?
Yes. The Endangered Species Act of 1973 was actually passed in December of 73, and the Fish and Wildlife Service in early 1974 began to sort of tool up for the act and try to figure out, you know, what was going to be required of them, because they had the major role in it, along with National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA. And so they started hiring, PhDs with specialties in different groups of organisms, plants and animals, and they did not have a fish person on the staff at the time, and that was in the summer of 1974. They advertised the job. It was passed on to me by a friend, otherwise I wouldn't have heard about it. And he said, you really should apply for this. And that friend was John Cooper, who was a PhD biologist, and John was a herpetologist. And he said, I should mention, I knew John Cooper by way of the Tennessee Tom Bigby Waterway lawsuit that I've been involved in. So he knew my expertise and background, and also from the Southeastern Fisheries Council, or Association of Southeastern Biologist meetings. Anyway, so I applied for the job. I get the job, and I knew it was going to be different, and I had no idea how different it was going to be. But I left Tuskegee sort of reluctantly, because I really loved it there. So I left there in August 74, got the Endangered Species Office, go to work the Tuesday after Labor Day, which I think was like the 3rd of September, 1974. And my first week on the job was sort of getting used to all these people in the office and like, okay, what am I supposed to do here? And I had read the Endangered Species Act, but I did not understand how federal regulations were developed. And I didn't understand that Congress passes the laws, they hand them off to the administration, and in this case, the Interior Department, Fish and Wildlife Service, and they develop the regulations as to how they will implement what's in the law.
Right.
And part of that implementation was, we need somebody to prepare documents for the Federal Register listing things as endangered and threatened. So that was where I came in. I was in the biological support branch, and everybody in there was a professional biologist and had advanced degrees, most of us, and knew our organisms well. And we started going through the literature, pulling out, well, this thing's rare, this has been listed as endangered before by, you know, X number of states, so we probably should look at that. And it really was an exciting time. And talking about a job, it was like, it was never ending. I mean, I could have worked, because I got there, there was no background information, except there had been a couple of previous acts, the Endangered Species Act of, I think, 66 and 69, might be off on those dates, but there are two previous versions of the Endangered Species Act, which led up to the 73 Act, and there had been some battles over things, but those laws had no teeth, basically.
Okay.
And the Endangered Species Act did. And, for example, the Devil's Hole pupfish case had gone on before I got there, and that was all over doing damage to a national monument, and that was what the lawsuit was about. And basically, they won. They got Devil's Hole designated as a national monument, and therefore you couldn't take all the water out of the ground because it'd dry up, and that would destroy the monument. So that's what the original lawsuit about the Devil's Hole pupfish was over. It came around the second time, by the way, a few years later, and ultimately went to the Supreme Court, and that was another one that it was one of the three or four early cases that it really told people that, hey, you better pay attention to this Endangered Species Act because they mean business, you know. So I started to work, and I was working on fishes in the southeast, which I knew personally. And then I had another group of fishes I was working on from the west, southwest, that I knew very little about because I had no firsthand experience with.
Okay.
And that was a park that I was really excited about. And a whole new world of fish and ichthyology that I'd never seriously gotten into other than just superficially knowing what's out there and in a vague general sort of way. And I was working along about the first couple of months, I guess, and all of a sudden I was called into a meeting down the assistant secretary's office. Nathaniel Reed was the assistant secretary then. And this, by the way, was after Nixon left. So his administration pretty much stayed in place, even though Gerald Ford took over after he left as president. But it was still pretty much the same people in place.
Okay.
But anyway, I was told that I had to drop everything I was doing, working on, and delist, not list, but delist, or downlist, I should say, from endangered down to threatened, three western trouts, because people were catching them, and every time they caught one, they could be in potential violation of federal law, even though they were game fish. And,
wait, hang on. Let me make sure I understand this. So you were asked to downlist a threatened species because the public was catching it.
Yep.
I don't see the logic there.
Well,
I mean,
here's what happened. When they passed the 73 Act, the Fish and Wildlife Service, under those two previous acts that I mentioned, they had developed lists of threatened and endangered species. They just didn't have a lot of information behind them. They simply had a couple of experts that called them up and said, hey, these things are in trouble. You should list these.
Okay.
And they put out a couple of versions of what was called a Red Book, which was the U.S. listed, or species that were on the U.S. list. And those trout got listed. Well, it didn't matter because those other acts had no teeth in them, so there's no big deal, you know. People went along and the problems were not catching them. The problem was habitat was disappearing.
Okay.
So basically, when the 73 Act was passed, and said everything that's on the old list gets carried onto the new list. When I got there, we had maybe 30 species, I think it was, of fish on the list already.
Okay.
And there were things like Devil's Hole pupfish and like some of the western trouts, Apache trout, Gila trout, Lahontan cutthroat trout.
I guess I'm still curious because if you downlist it so the public can catch it, why will there be enough fish to go around?
Well, the problem was what we did in writing under the Endangered Species Act. You're allowed to write regulations for threatened species.
Okay.
And so what we did, I wrote a special rule that said basically these species are threatened from destruction of habitat.
Okay.
And they may be taken in accordance with state conservation laws and regulations.
Okay.
So that left it up to states to regulate, you know, any kind of numbers and length you know, sizes, whatever, or seasons.
And some fish, you know, the fishermen are educated. Okay, you can't take that fish. If you get it on your hook and you land it in, you got to put it back.
That's correct.
Now, that might not have been the consciousness back in 1974.
Well, you're also right about that. That was certainly one of my concerns. And at the same time, you know, this is one of those political things. The Assistant Secretary was trying to convince some of the more conservative Western states, like Arizona and like Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, that we want to work with you. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not the heavy hand of the federal government coming in telling you what to do with your fish and wildlife.
Right.
So we're going to work together on this. In order to gain their trust and to try to encourage them to do things for other fishes or other organisms that we're going to list, the Assistant Secretary said, you know, we're going to downlist these, and you should write a special rule to allow take in accordance with their laws and regulations. And that's what I did.
Okay.
And but it just really hit me when I thought about it. I thought, damn, I thought I was coming up here to to add things to the list to save them, and here I am taking them down. I'm taking them off the list.
Right.
I think I'm from endangered down to threatened. And see, that was another problem with the original list that got carried forward under the 73 Act. There was no, in the old legislation, there was only one category, endangered.
Okay.
So there was no threatened category. So some of the things that went on as endangered did not need to be endangered. They were maybe threatened, like the trout.
Okay.
But they were not endangered extinction.
Got it.
Like that, which is one of the requirements for an endangered listing.
Mm.
So that was my first federal register documents were downlisting three Western trouts from endangered to threatened. But beyond that, I got into it. And,
how did that work? Meaning, you went to the Federal Register, you put in the listing, you downlisted them to threatened instead of endangered, and the states were responsible then to go ahead and manage how they were going to have their fishermen work with that fish. How did that turn out? It's been, 74, 94, 2004, 2014. It's coming up now to 50 years.
Yeah, it's almost 50 years. And they're still here.
Okay, that's good.
Basically, they're probably better off now, even though they're downlisted, because we know more about what was the threat all along was habitat.
Okay.
And basically, if you take the water away from fish, you've got a problem.
Right.
And that's what was happening. And so we've got the other thing is some of those were listed as subspecies.
Okay.
And some of the genetics work that's been done, I have not followed this in recent years, but I know some of them, they may not be as distinct as we thought genetically.
Oh, okay.
But they still qualified because there's some morphological differences, color differences, which you can always list it as a separate population, because that's one of the things you can do under the Endangered Species Act of 73 is list vertebrate populations. So if you've got, you know, a southern population of this thing that's more widespread up north, it may be common up there, but you want to save the southern population because it may look a little different or it may behave a little different, whatever. You can list that population of fish or frogs, lizards, whatever. So, it was the listing process. Basically, I prepare a document that says, you know, this thing's endangered or threatened, or not endangered, it is threatened, and why. And from there, that goes through the approval process of the office chief, the director of Fish and Wildlife Service, up to the assistant secretary, and eventually it goes back to the secretary to be published in the Federal Register.
Okay.
And then that's a proposal. You get public comment period, and if you get comments in, which we usually did, and from there you address those comments and publish the final rule, and you make any changes, and between the proposal and final rule, They still need the comments to come in if there are substantial comments. Most of them are just, we don't think this should be listed as not endangered, or you should list this as endangered, not threatened. And we got a little bit of pushback on some of the trouts, but I tried to explain. People look, in talking with the biologist in Nevada, Game and Fish, about the line cuts of trout, for example, they said these things can no longer run up the Truckee River to spawn, and, you know, but now they can because I think it's Bureau of Reclamation to put in a BLM, Bureau of Reclamation, I guess, put in a fish ladder on the lower Truckee River, and now they can make spawning runs at the river and spawn, and there's more of them now than there used to be, and that's, they couldn't spawn them before because there was so little water left in the river.
Right.
But basically, they couldn't get upstream and to reach spawning grounds.
So this sounds like a great job to be pushed on by people saying this doesn't need to be listed, and pushed on the other side by people saying this is endangered or this is about ready to go to extinct. And
yeah.
And then, of course, there's the political pressures piled on top of that. Wow.
That's what I learned very, very quickly.
Huh.
I could never make, it seems I would go home sometimes late at night thinking, I don't know how to handle this because I was getting pressure from the conservation groups on some occasions to do more, to list, and then I was getting pressure from basically internally the Fish and Wildlife Service, slow down, this is not, you've got to have more data, and then you got pressure from the outside saying, if you list this, we're going to sue because that's going to interrupt our activities or whatever we're doing. And then there's the politicians, of course, on the Hill that are writing letters. And that was the other thing that was really, at the time I didn't realize how important it was in my life, but it became so evident after about 2 or 3 years. We had these things called congressionals. And these were letters from either somebody in the House or Senate that was ticked off about the Endangered Species Act or about some little 3-inch fish in their district or their state that was causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
And when what they're doing is they'd write Secretary of Interior would send it down, or the Director of Fish and Wildlife Service, either one, and they'd send that to our office in a red folder. And you knew that if you saw a red folder in your inbox one morning, you better drop everything and answer that immediately.
Hmm.
I mean, it was like a fire drill. And what it taught me to do very quickly, I learned how to write in a way that I'd never written before in my life.
Wow.
In that, how do you answer somebody that's really ticked off about a particular listed species in a particular state and try to make them appreciate what we're doing, but at
right.
the same time, explain to them we understand how you feel about this, and we should work together to make things better, and yada, yada, yada. But, boy, that was something I can remember. There, some of the things I listed would have maybe, you know, I'd walk in one morning, there's 6 or 7 congressionals to deal with. And it's like, oh, God, you know, what am I going to eat? And you just drop everything, and you don't eat lunch. You don't go home till 9 o'clock at night, but you get them done. And at that time, this is another thing. Some of the biologists had typewriters in their office, and they could type drafts, but they basically would send over a draft to the director's office, Director of Fish and Wildlife Service office, and they would approve it, and then it would come back, and it would get finalized for signature. Well, think about it. We didn't have computers in 1974, 75, in the early 70s, mid, late 70s even. And so we had a pool of typists that sat out in this kind of little collective area. And I was assigned a typist, and her name was Brenda Coleman. And Brenda, I learned very quickly that the nicer you are to your support people, the faster your work gets done.
Oh, that's nice. Uh-huh.
And, Brenda was just a fantastic woman. She just could, she could do, one thing she could do is read my handwriting, which at that time was not very, operation, and along the way, I kept digging into southeastern fishes that I knew very well. I knew where the literature was. I could pick up the phone and call people and say, did you send me some information on this? Or could you check on this for me? And, you know, could you look in the museum at some collection and give me locality data for all these things? So
cool.
I had some idea of where and when. And so I relied a lot on my southeastern connections for my southeastern fish listings. And then for the southwest, I made my first trip to the western United States. Well, that's not true. My first trip to the western United States was with my mom and dad. That would have been about 1953, somewhere along there, when my brother was getting out of the service. I mean, he never went to Korea, but he was basically in the Army for a couple of years because he got drafted.
Okay.
But he was in the officer training corps, whatever, ROTC, program in Alabama when he got drafted. But anyway, he was in White Sands, New Mexico, proving grounds.
Oh, wow.
And so we went out there, and I was like 12 years old, I guess. And
so hang on, let's explore that for just a little bit before I go back to sand. Don't all those red folders mean you're doing your job? So before I ask that question, I think of you growing up as sort of like the roots of a tree growing out of the side of a muddy bank with water, and you can't see the sky because it's so heavily overgrown overhead. What were your thoughts of White Sands as a 12-year-old?
Oh, God, I was just blown away. I mean, I loved it. There was something about the starkness of the desert with no trees, and it's like, wow, look at this. I mean, I loved it. I absolutely fell in love with it. And
wow.
It's like, it was so different from what I'd grown up in, and where you couldn't see, you know, over the next ridge for all the trees. And it was just a totally different world to me. And I got some appreciation of it driving from, we went to see family in Louisiana and stayed there for a couple of days and then continued on west to Texas. And as we got into West Texas and started getting drier and less trees, it's like, wow, this is really something. I remember watching the sunset as we're driving, and it's like the sun was just right there, and you just kept going and going and going. You know? And the sun just kept getting farther away, it seemed. So, but yeah, it was fascinating. I was young, and so anyway, we picked my brother up and go back to Alabama, but that was my only exposure to the West until November. It would have been November 1974, and the Desert Fishes Council meetings, which had only been around about 6 or 7 years. It was formed by a bunch of southwestern biologists, aquatic fishery-type biologists and conservationists during the battle over the Devil's Hole pupfish.
Okay.
And it was made up primarily of professors, grad students, state and federal biologist. And so I made arrangements to go to that, and it was meeting in Death Valley.
Okay.
So I fly into Las Vegas and rent a car and drive to Death Valley National Park, and that's where I met Phil Feaster, who was California Fish and Game guy that sort of was the backbone of the Desert Fishes Council meeting.
How do you spell Phil's?
Then, but
how do you spell Phil's last name?
Feaster, P-I-S-T-E-R.
Okay, sorry. And what was his role with the Desert Fishes Council?
He was actually, I think, president, secretary.
Okay.
He held several different offices, but he was the one that organized it a few years earlier to take on the pumping interest in Ash Meadows that was destroying the Devil's Hole pupfish.
Okay.
But I also met Chuck Minkley there, who was a professor at Arizona State University, and Jim Deacon, who was at University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
How do you spell Jim's last name?
Pardon?
How do you spell Jim's last name?
Oh, Deacon, D-E-A-C-O-N.
Okay, and Chuck is Minkley?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And we, I mean, they were the main player. Well, there's a couple of others. There were people from Michigan that had studied desert fishes in the 1930s and 40s.
Wow.
And some of them went into the 50s. And they were also in attendance. And I knew them from meetings in the eastern United States of the American Society of Ichthyologists and Herpetologists.
Like who? Do you remember their names?
Oh, yes. It was Dr. Carl Hubbs, H-U-B-B-S, and Dr. Robert Rush Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R.
What do you remember about these people, Hubbs and Miller?
Oh, they were basically the... they were the rocks and foundation of ichthyology in the United States at the time.
Okay.
They were University of Michigan. They'd been there for years. They had worked on fishes all over the United States. There were pictures of Carl Hubbs driving a Model T around the desert collecting fishes.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. And so I go to this first meeting, Desert Fishing Council meeting. I meet all these people, and then on the top of those guys from the universities, there was a whole host of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service people that I talked to on the phone but never met, so I got to meet them.
Okay.
And there were people that worked for BLM, and Bureau of Reclamation, and there were tons of them. And so I got, and some of those I'd talked to, but I met some new ones. So I made tons of contacts all of a sudden, and that was probably one of the busiest periods of my life for the next couple of 3 months. After I got back, November, December, January, trying to follow up on all the leads I'd gotten from the Western United States. And the only way I could do that was phone calls. And I was known in the office to live practically on the telephone.
Wow.
And, so that started a flow of information, though. That 1974 Desert Fishes Council meeting started a flow of information that on all the potentially threatened endangered fishes in the West.
Okay.
And that was a gold mine. So that became, the Desert Fishes Council meeting became the most important meeting for me in my professional work at the Endangered Species Office for about the next 10 years. Because it was every year I had to go out there, but I usually presented something. It was usually on the status of listing of this fish or that fish and where we were. And I don't know, it was just a great group of people. I mean, it was just, and there were no different than my friends in the Southeast, except the big difference was that in the West, you had Bureau of Reclamation, BLM, Park Service, Forest Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs. You had five federal agencies right there that just had tons of biologists down. And in the southeastern United States, we don't have that.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, we ultimately formed the Southeastern Fishes Council, which we copied off the experience and success of the Desert Fishes Council meetings. And it's basically a few state fisheries biologists will show up occasionally, but it's primarily universities and grad students. And that's because we don't have BLM in the Southeast, or North for Reclamation, or BIA. We have Forest Service, but they still have a lot of aquatic people employed. And so it's two totally different worlds, Southeast and Southwest. But
you do have the Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, but they don't generally show up at our meetings.
Well, that's not your problem.
Actually, some of them do.
Okay.
They're nothing like BLM in the West and Bureau of Reclamation. I mean, that's those two agencies out there, as you know, being from out there, do a lot with water.
Right. And something that comes to mind here right away is, when did you get some help? Because I just think of I mean, the Southeast, the Southwest desert fishes, what about the Northwest and the salmon and all those fishes? And what about the Northeast and the Great Lakes? And the more I think about it, the more I come to realize you're outgunned. You know, you have to deal with congressionals and everything else. Wow.
Well, think about it like this, Tom. The Northeastern United States and Midwest was scraped clean 18,000 years ago by a big chunk of ice.
Okay.
And the Pleistocene glaciers basically pushed everything to the south that was in that part of the country. As they retreated, things moved back up. But what you don't have is all the endemism that we have in the Southeast and the Southwest. So during the Pleistocene, when the lake levels in the Southwest were higher, like Death Valley at one time was a big lake.
Right. Salt Lake, the Great Salt Lake out of Salt Lake City. I mean, all of
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So you had all those lakes that when the Pleistocene ended and the glaciers started retreating and things started drying up, then you had these desert springs left. Well, in the Southeast, we didn't dry out. We still had streams, but those streams drained into the ocean, and they got shorter maybe, they got longer as the glaciers retreated because of meltwater and the sea levels rise.
Right.
So they got shorter, and basically you left a lot of things isolated that diverged and became genetically distinct species. So
what you're saying is in the Northeast, anywhere they got scraped away by an ice mass, really didn't have a chance to develop unique species.
Exactly. And we did have a few things in the Great Lakes because there was some glacial relics and things that got pushed south and then moved back north.
Huh.
But most of them, by the time we got there, had already, some of the Ciscos and some of the, there's like a blue pike that may or may not have been genetically distinct. We don't know because basically it was gone by the 1950s.
Okay.
It was overfished, by the way.
Okay.
As were some of the Ciscos. But there was also pollution involved. So, I mean, one of the things that made it such a problem there is like you've got all these potential things that were distinct, but there's nothing left of them. Or they've hybridized, in the case of Ciscos, maybe out of existence.
Hmm.
So, yeah, and to the Northwest, we actually had a few people in BLM, Bureau of Reclamation, mostly, that were bringing our attention to, hey, there's some Western time lines here that need to be listed. But that was such a huge problem, and we didn't have a lot of data to go with it at the time. And that's all changed now. We have a much better handle on that, and we generally know now genetically what's distinct and what's not, and that's made that very different. But again, the Southwest, very much like the Southeast, but there you have a case where the endemism, a lot of the endemism is in springs, and spring isolated systems or desert river systems, and the Southeast is just in rivers. We have a few things in that it's springs here, but mostly it's in streams.
It's funny because when I think of the West, and I'm including the Northwest, and I think of the Endangered Species Act in late 1973, I'm thinking, well, that was 20 years too late because Glen Canyon was online, Flaming Gorge was online, Hoover Dam had come online, all the Snake River, Hell's Canyon dams had come in online. All the Columbia dams, there were a ton of dams in the West that had severely altered fisheries, river systems, and so you guys were sort of a day late and a dollar short and 20 to 40 years too late.
Well, we were, you're absolutely 100% correct. I mean, it's amazing. During the World War II and post-World War II years, it seems like progress in terms of Congress, they viewed Congress as a chunk of concrete in a river in their district.
Interesting.
And interestingly enough, we were, it's no different in the Southeast. For the freshwater mussels in the Southeast, for example, there were dams being built on the Coosa River, large river in East Alabama, that we had things in there that disappeared and that went extinct in the 1960s.
Wow.
The snails and mussels, and it's like, well, you know, there's an interesting little side note here. A guy that was a hobbyist, a conchologist, if you will, a shell collector, and he's collecting in the Coosa River in the 1960s as water's backing up from the last dam they built in the Coosa.
Oh, wow.
And he's collecting these snails in a monotypic genus, only one species in the genus, Tulatoma, and or Gyrotoma, I'm sorry, G-Y-R-O-T-O-M-A, Gyrotoma.
Thank you.
And so he's collecting Gyrotoma, and he writes in his notes, last call for Gyrotoma.
Wow.
So here's a hobbyist in 1960, I think that was like 65, 66 maybe, that knows this thing is going extinct. And I'm sitting at the University of Alabama, along with the faculty and Alabama and Auburn and other Eastern institutions, not realizing there's a whole genus of freshwater snail that's going extinct right before our, and nobody knew about it.
Wow.
Because we'd had no expertise in malacology in the Southeastern United States. And that all changed with the Endangered Species Act, by the way. And the way it changed was, for the first time, a lot of these invertebrate groups that were not very well known, or a lot of even things like freshwater fishes, we knew they were sort of out there, but we didn't know if they were distinct or not. Is that one species or two? Gee, they look a little different. But the work on fishes started in the 1960s, and I don't know really other than there was a lot of people that began to ask questions about are we going to save all these things or not, because dams were being built at such a rapid rate in the Southeast. And the dam builders in the Southeast, a little bit different from the West, it was Alabama Power Company, Georgia Power Company, Tennessee Valley Authority. Those were the three biggies that were just damming everything that flowed. Put a dam on it. And it was maddening during the 50s and 60s. And but it drove, I think, people in universities and to say, what are we losing here? You know, people are saying, hey, we have no rivers left if you dam this up.
Right.
The public is saying that. And as a result, I think universities, and it was sort of this process of, well, maybe we should start looking at these things. And then as the acts were passed in the late 60s about, we got to list these things that are going extinct, that drove it even more. And by the 1973 Act, ichthyology was going full tilt in the Southeastern United States.
Okay.
However, malacology was not. And what the Endangered Species Act did, it forced states to take account, inventory organisms that might be candidates for the endangered species list.
Okay.
And if the states didn't want to do that, which a lot of them didn't, as we used to call it, the hook and bullet crowd, the hunters and the fishermen, could care less about snails. And a lot of the state agencies, game and fish agencies at the time, were run by license sales. So, you know, you couldn't take license money and go out and survey for snails.
Right.
That was inappropriate. So that was where the Endangered Species Act made funds available to go out and do some of these surveys. And it really did push us to get data on invertebrates, whether it was crayfish, whether it was snails, mussels. And that was that's one of the side benefits of the Endangered Species Act that rarely gets mentioned. I think a lot of people don't realize it, don't recognize it. But boy, when you work there, you know. I started working on a list of Alabama muscles in the 1970s, and I did it because I was a native Alabamian, and I'd collected some when I was working on the 10-time waterway lawsuit. I got interested in them, and even though we had a malacologist in the office, and I passed on all the muscle information to him. His name was Mark Emily, I-M-L-A-Y, and Mark was he was gung-ho for listing all these things, and he got the reputation farther up the line that he was pushing things too far too fast, which a lot of us did. I had the same reputation. And but it was one that I think the inverted part of the list was really difficult to convince people. It's like, well, what good are they? And, of course, I learned something from Phil Pista early on. His comeback for that is always, well, what good are you?
Exactly. Yeah, well done.
So just
because we don't know a species' role in the ecosystem isn't a reason to say we don't need it.
Yeah, ignorance is no excuse here. And you can always get rid of it later, so save it for later and make those decisions. But, it was that ride in the Endangered Species Office from 1974 to 1987 was quite the ride.
I bet.
Quite the ride.
I bet. Okay, so
One other little sidelight in there was when I got there, all of my friends in the South were calling me saying, hey, Jim, you need to list this. Well, one of them was a guy named Bob Mount, M-O-U-N-T, it's from Auburn University. And Robert Mount was herpetologist at Auburn. And he said, he called me up one day and said, you got to list the Red Hill Salamander. And I knew about Red Hill Salamander. I'd looked for them and seen them when I was in grad school. And they're only found in a little patch of north-facing slopes, which are wetter, cooler,
okay,
in South Alabama. And they're only found in a few little hilly areas down there where there's nice damp ravines and on these north-facing slopes. So I proposed to list the Red Hill Salamander, thinking no problem. And this is also, by the way, where I learned about people in the press and how they can sound really friendly on the phone.
Oh.
And then they carve you up the next day on the front page. And so after this proposal came out in the Federal Register, I was the one that prepared it. This guy calls me up in the Mobile Press Register. He said, Jim, how are things going in? I didn't know him from Adam. We got to talking. I was from Alabama, so he was, I think, a Bama fan, or at least purported to be one on the phone. And so I told him, I said, look, this thing is not controversial, and I said, it's not going to, you know, harm anything by listing it, and it will make some provisions for protection of its habitat. And he said, well, what do you mean by protection of habitat? I said, well, it'll make available some funds maybe for the state and Fish and Wildlife Service to purchase some easements on land and prevent logging of those north-facing slopes to protect the habitat. Now, mind you, this is only a few north-facing slopes in a couple of counties in South Alabama. Well, the Mobile Press Register the next day said, salamander listening to stop timber harvest in South Alabama.
Wow.
And boy, oh boy, talking about an explosion.
Oh, I bet.
And that was, a little bit later, that was when I had a handful of congressionals on the next day.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to go over and brief the director and tell him what happened. And that was sort of a regular occasion or a regular sort of thing.
Who was the director at the time?
That was Lynn Greenwald. And Lynn Greenwald was probably probably the best Fish and Wildlife Service director ever. He was born on a refuge in Oklahoma. His dad was a refuge manager. He went on to get his advanced degrees. I think he only had a master's, but he got in wildlife management. And he just risen up through the ranks. And he was absolutely fantastic. I mean, he understood the push and pull from politicians and developers and resource users. And he also understood the desires of the conservation community and different groups. And he tried to do a balancing act, explain to both of them, let's do what's right for the organism and for the habitat, and we'll all be happy.
Right.
But anyway, that led to the hiring temporarily Dr. Ken Dodd, D-O-D-D, and Ken's a herpetologist. And the reason I knew about Ken Dodd was a few months before I listed the salamander, I was sitting at home reading the Washington Post, greatest newspaper in the United States. And so I'm reading the Washington Post, and here's an editorial on the 10-ton waterway. And I'm thinking, what the hell's going on here?
Huh.
I read it, and it just blasted the hell out of Corps of Engineers.
Oh, wow.
I'm thinking, wow, this is great. Who is this guy? And so I called my friend Glenn Klemmer, who's still in his estate at the time. I said, Glenn, there's an editorial. I called him the same day. I mean, I couldn't get to the phone quick enough. And he said, oh, that's Ken Dodd. He said, he was a herpetologist here on a postdoc filling in for the herpetologist that had taken a year off, a sabbatical.
Okay.
And I said, well, you know where he lives? He said, yeah, he's living in Virginia, Northern Virginia. And I think it was like in Alexandria, Old Town, something just across the river from D.C. And so Glenn had his phone number.
Oh, wow.
So I called him up and thanked him for his editorial and asked him if he was where he was working. He said, well, I'm unemployed right now. I'm applying for jobs. And I said, well, let me see if I can get you a temporary job here at least to handle this problem with the salamander.
Oh, wow.
And Ken came in on a, I think the government has all sorts of temporary appointments. I think his was like a 180-day appointment.
Okay.
Which is basically a fairly short window of time to be able to come in and do something.
Right.
But during that 180-day appointment, maybe 120-day appointment, but anyway, whatever, he comes in and not only deals with the red-nosed salamanders, he starts listing, writing all these proposals for these other herbs. Well, that's great because we didn't have herpetologists in the office at the time.
Nice.
So he writes these proposals, and then that creates, it just mushroomed from there. That created a whole bunch of other, not necessarily controversies, but needs for herpetologists. And finally, after a couple of three temporary appointments, they just hired him outright, full-time permanent job.
Great.
And Ken wound up in Gainesville along with me when they busted up the office. And only he got here a year before I did. But outstanding biologist, outstanding conservation biologist and herpetologist.
So this sounds good because you know basically it sounded like you were understaffed, and overwhelmed,
yep.
And so bringing in Ken, to look at, you know, more species, would have been really helpful.
Yeah, I mean he was really. Ken's one of the best writers I've ever known, and one of the hardest working, most committed conservationists I know. And like the world out of him. He's like I am. He's retired. Ken's probably 10 years younger than I am.
Okay.
But he's still writing, still publishing.
Good for him.
And he still writes editorials in the local papers about conservation issues.
Oh,
which
good.
I love. It's
cool.
Just typical Ken, and we all appreciate him so much for that. But, it was just an example of one discipline that wasn't covered, so I was trying to fill in, help out my friend Bob Mount, and because it's fun. You know, this thing is just, it would only have taken another 10 or 15 years of timber harvest for that thing to totally have disappeared.
Right.
And so, you know, we all knew this, the habitat shrinking, because with every purchase of timber, with mixed pine hardwood forest this in, but they would go in and cut out the pine, the hardwood, and when you do that, you take out the overstory, and it dries out, the salamander dies.
Right.
I mean, it has to have these damp north-facing slopes.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think of logging of the redwoods, which was happening at the same time in the West, and you know, all kinds of other logging happening on U.S. Forest Service lands, mining, dams. I mean, there's any number of extractive industries that are hell on wheels for the ecosystem that we just don't think about.
It's really, you know, when you get into Southern Appalachians and Gulf Coastal Plain, you get into all these endemics, and very few people know this, but 20% of the state of Alabama is owned by large forestry.
Oh, wow.
Businesses. And they're somewhat appreciative of aquatic habitats. They do have some, they try to leave riparian, and some do a better job than others. You know, it depends on, in a way, it depends on who's out there supervising the cut.
Okay.
As to how committed they are in terms of BMPs or best management practices to protect riparian areas. But that's, pine forests, they're biological deserts. I mean, they're like cornfield. You don't get much growing in a cornfield except corn.
Right.
And pine farms, you don't get much growing except pines. So, and that goes for wildlife. So.
Right.
But yeah, that's it was a challenging time there in the Endangered Species Office, and during that time, two kids are growing up, and my first wife and I wound up getting a divorce in 1980.
Okay.
And I remarried in 1981 and got custody of my three kids, and my ex-wife got them on the weekends, and split time with them on holidays, typical sort of thing. Well, it's a little bit atypical because I got custody of the kids.
Right.
And there was, I realized that when we decided to get a divorce, that there's no way that I can afford a place in downtown D.C. where I'd be comfortable bringing the kids in for the weekend. I mean, it would have been a townhouse somewhere downtown in D.C. where things were not as safe as in the 70s as they are perhaps today. I don't know. But it would just been, and I finally told my wife, I said, we're going to have to work this out because I'm not leaving my kids. And she said, well, you just get custody of the kids and stay in the house and I'll move out. I said, that's fine.
Okay.
So that's what we did. And I was single probably for about a year. I remarried the next year. And my second wife and I moved to Gainesville, Florida. And we left D.C. area in 1987 and moved to Gainesville. And by the time I left the D.C. area, the Endangered Species Office had become so, quote, unmanageable. Because the biologists there, we figured out that after we all got tenured, so to speak, that you couldn't fire us for doing our job. And if you ask us to do something that's not right, we have the right of refusal. It's not the Army, you know. It's like, I can remember some things. I got a petition one time to list the northeast population of the Atlantic salmon. And it came down with a note on it. It said, here's this petition that came in the director. The note very clearly said, just write a notice that you looked at this and that it does not need listing, and we'll send it back over and we'll put it in the register.
Wow.
And I said, well, no, I'm not going to do that. And it's like, what do you mean you aren't going to do it? I said, well, because I'm not going to do it until I look and see. I mean, I don't know that it doesn't need listing.
Right.
And I thought, I don't have any information on that. I knew that Atlantic salmon were still a few up in the northeast, but I didn't know what was going on with them. So I spent, you know, the next few weeks looking into it. And I finally told him, I said, no, I'm not going to write that. I said, I think this thing may qualify for listing. And that just sent shockwaves because, again, kind of like the Western trout, they were being harvested. And so basically they, somebody else, I think, wrote the notice, one of the lawyers, because I didn't write it. I said, no, I'm not doing it. It's not right. And everybody in that office had a boatload of integrity. I'll give you that. We all said no. We don't say that something should be listed when it shouldn't, and we don't say things should be taken off the list when they shouldn't. And
but what you're saying here, Jim, was that a director could get a lawyer to go ahead and write something for inclusion in the Federal Register, and the employees couldn't do basically anything about it. If they saw, here was a species that needed protection possibly, and it was being delisted, or something was being posted in the register saying there's no need to worry about this.
Yeah. Well,
what would you do? Could you do?
There's nothing you can do except you go to conservation groups.
Right.
And that was one of my problems. And when I said we became unmanageable, by this time, by the 1980s, we had such strong ties to the conservation community that it just basically, they didn't know basically what to do with us. And we were, at the time I joined the service in 74, we were downtown Washington, D.C., 1612 K Street, Washington, D.C. And we were a little bit cramped for space, but they needed to remove us from the conservation community, which was located in the downtown area on Connecticut Avenue, Mass Avenue, and those downtown conservation community headquarters. It's like, okay, stop in the endangered species office and say hello to so-and-so and see what's going on. And we would basically tell them that, this needs to be done and that needs to be done. It was called an end run.
Uh-huh.
And E-N-D run. And basically what it was doing is basically us talking to the conservation community. Then the conservation community goes over and jumps on the Interior Department, well, on the Director of Fish and Wildlife Service. And it's like, how did you know about that? Where did that come from?
Right.
I didn't tell them. I didn't tell you anything.
But this is nothing new. I mean, the National Parks, the National Parks Association, who was, formed right with the National Parks, so that when something happened, the association could write the letter and work from the outside. To protect
and that's,
the park.
That's the way we operate.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, but they moved us across the river to Arlington, Virginia.
Like telephones hadn't been invented? I don't know.
Well, they moved us over there because we had less access, direct access. I mean, you could still call them up.
Right.
But they used to just drop in.
Okay.
Because we were right in the middle of downtown D.C.
Okay.
And coming and going from the bus, and hop off the bus, go up, a few flight stairs, and bam, there we are.
Okay.
And 1612K. And so it was, we were very convenient, very convenient. And we still had the connections. And then a few years later, they decided even moving us to Virginia didn't really make them happy. So they reorganized the office. And that's when they took the listing responsibility away from the Washington office and put it out in the state and regional offices to get it closer to the ground was what they were trying to do.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so that was when they cast us to the four winds. So the dozen or so biologists that we had in the endangered species office wound up going different places, and a few of them stayed in the D.C. area with a different agency doing different things, but I think maybe one or two of them went to the Forest Service in D.C., and as I said, Ken got sent down here the year before I did, and I was one of the last ones. I came down in 87.
It's funny because I don't see this as being a wise move for environmental integrity. I see this as a wise move for the extractive industry, if you will.
It was political.
Yeah.
It was political.
So that's that. I mean, that's sort of the political end game, which needs another political chess move. Was that next move taken to counter this move? And I don't know what it would be.
I don't know. Basically, when they moved the listing to the regional offices or to the field stations, for example, in the southeast, there was a listing biologist in Asheville, North Carolina. There was one in Panama City, Florida. And there was one in Jackson, Mississippi. And the one in Asheville, North Carolina, had to cover Tennessee and North Carolina.
Hmm.
And the one in Jackson had to cover Mississippi and most of Alabama. And the one in Panama City covered a little Florida and a little bit of Georgia. Georgia, I guess, was split in the way between, because some of it had ranges that went into Alabama for aquatics. And they had different rules for aquatic terrestrial splits, anyway. But, yeah, what it did, it broke up that really tight connection to conservation groups that we all had at the national level. And so it was fairly disruptive for a while, but it's hard to say. If you go back and look at if you just take the raw listing actions and plot it, the number of species listed by year, you can pretty much look at the curve you get in, say, Republican administration, Democrat, Republican, Republican, Democrat. And because under Republican administrations, most of them hate the Endangered Species Act.
Right.
And that hasn't changed. And don't want anything that's going to hold up, quote, progress.
Right.
So they basically would slow up listing packages. I remember when James Watt became Secretary of Interior.
This was 1980?
That was a disaster. That would have been when Reagan came in. That would have been 80, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a meeting of the Washington office staff, this Wildlife Service, Park Service, and down in the main auditorium. And he gets up and he says, we're going to have a different way of doing business now. There's new people in charge, and we're going to do things our way. And he had the directors of Park Service, BLM, Bureau of Reclamation, all sitting down in the front row, along with Lynn Greenwald. And before the entire staff of Park Service and Fish and Wildlife Service, he summarily fired Lynn Greenwald.
Right there.
Right there on the spot.
Wow.
The best director we ever had. And I thought to myself, this guy is going to be bad news.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be very bad news.
Wow.
Probably the worst Secretary of Interior ever. And he did things for spite. I mean, he could have called in Greenwald and said, look, you were brought in on the old administration, and we're changing guard here, so you will resign. I mean, that's a usual way. Everybody, once the new administration gets in, you offer your resignation. They either accept it or reject it. But he came in and immediately called this convocation of all the employees of Fish and Wildlife and Park Service, and summarily fired Lynn Greenwald.
Wow.
And the Park Service director stayed, but he had to change his team to the point of saying, we don't need new parks, we just need to fix up the ones we got.
Hmm.
And we can do that, you know, a few at a time. We can, basically he was saying, we aren't going to do anything except maintain what we've got and hope they don't fall apart. We'll see what happens. But it was for the first two or three years under Reagan, nothing got listed.
Wow.
Nothing. I sat there and wrote Federal Register documents, send them over. They'd get reviewed by the solicitor office.
Right.
And the solicitor's office would come back saying, no, this doesn't seem quite right. I think this needs to be cleaned up a little bit and rewrite it. It's like, well, could you give me any specifics here? What are we talking about? Well, it's just generally not written the right way. Or they just made up stuff to send it back.
Wow.
But they would sit on it, first of all, they'd sit on it for like a month or a month and a half, and then send it back and say, this needs to be redone. So it was bad times. I mean, that was about the time I was going through a divorce, so that didn't help either. And but it was, that's politics. And it was no different under Trump, where they did everything they could to slow things down, and the only thing they wanted to do was figure out ways to make the act less effective and through regulations. And they sort of tried to figure out a way even to threaten federal employees. I don't know the nitty-gritty details of this, but they were going to come up with a new category, basically we're all civil service if you're a government employee. But there are different schedules of employees.
Hmm.
And the Schedule C is a political appointee. So those are the Schedule C appointments were the ones that, when administrations change, you can usually expect those to change.
Right.
And so when Trump came in, I know they were talking about, I don't know the nitty-gritty of this. I won't go into it. But basically, they're coming out with another schedule. I mean, what they were going to call it. If it was F, or I think it was Schedule F for fired. But basically, it's going to be like a political appointee, which means you could be fired for any reason at all or without reason, give you 2 weeks' notice, and you're gone.
Right. I think I remember hearing something about that.
That schedule is going to apply to anyone in federal service.
Hmm.
That had anything to do with policy.
Hmm.
Well, it's hard not to work in Fish and Wildlife Service and not have something to do with policy. If
right.
you're at any upper grade level, GS 11, 12, 13. And I'm not sure how that all got resolved. I didn't follow it. But that's just an example of
right.
how politics plays in federal agencies. That and don't ever think it doesn't.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no.
It trickles all the way down.
So I'm going to back up here a little bit. We've been going for a little over an hour, and I'm thinking that you ended up in Grand Canyon looking at Southwest fishes in 74. Is that right?
That sounds about right.
Or 76.
Oh, well, 74. Right. 76 is actually the year I went down the canyon. Yeah.
Okay. So what? Let's.
My first exposure to Western fishes really was 74. With the endangered or with the Desert Fishes Council meeting,
right?
But then that was the beginning of it. But it wasn't until '76 I went down the canyon.
Okay, so what? Let's do. We'll wrap up here, part four, and
right.
then we'll talk a little bit about how to wrap back into Grand Canyon for part five.
All right.
That sounds great. All right. Well, with that, this will put a comma in this interview series and conclude part four. Of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Williams. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Tuesday, September 7th, 2021. And Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you.